course. Looked for a note. None, of course. Poured herself a glass of wine and sat by the window, waiting for him to come home on his own. It was 2:45 in the morning when the phone finally rang. It was the police. Was she? Was her son? Did she own? Tan Audi. License plate. She answered, yes. 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 Until she stopped hearing the questions, just kept saying, yes. Then she hung up and called Mona, who came over and picked her up, drove her quietly to the police station. They stopped, and Mona put her hand on Deborah's. Good Mona. 10 years younger and square-shouldered, bob-haired, with sharp green eyes. She'd tried to kiss Deborah once after too many glasses of wine. You can always spot the real thing, that affection. Why does it always come from the wrong person? Deborah, Mona said, I know you love that little fucker, but you can't put up with his shit anymore. You hear me? Let him go to jail this time. He was doing better, Deborah said weakly. He wrote this song, but she didn't finish. She thanked Mona, got out of the car, and went into the police station. A thick, uniformed officer in teardrop glasses came out with a clipboard. He said not to worry, her son was fine, but her car was totaled. It had gone over an abutment in Fremont. A spectacular crash. Amazing no one was hurt. No one? There was a girl in the car with him. She's fine, too. Scared, but fine. Her parents already came down. Of course there was a girl. Can I see him? In a minute, the officer said. But first she needed to know that her son had been intoxicated, that they'd found a vodka bottle and cocaine residue on a hand mirror in the car, that he was being cited for negligent driving, driving without a license, failure to use proper care and caution, driving under the influence, minor in possession. Cocaine? She wasn't sure she'd heard right, but she nodded at each charge. What else could she do? Given the severity of the charges, this matter would be turned over to the juvenile prosecutor, who would make a determination. Wait, cocaine? Where would he get cocaine? And what did P.E. Steve mean that she didn't let people in? She'd love to let someone in. No, you know what she'd love to do? Let herself out. And Mona? Don't put up with his shit. Jesus, did they think she chose to be this way? Did they think she had a choice in the way Pat behaved? God, that would be something. Just stop putting up with Pat's shit. Go back in time and live some other life. Dee Morey reclines on a beach chair on the Riviera with her quiet, handsome Italian companion Pasquale, reading the trades until Pasquale kisses her and goes off to play tennis on this court jutting out of the cliffs. Any questions? I'm sorry? Any questions about what I've just told you? No. She followed the fat cop down a hallway. This might not be the best time, he said, and glanced back at her over his shoulder as they walked. But I noticed that you're not wearing a wedding ring. I wondered if maybe sometime you might want to have dinner. The legal system can be really confusing, and it can help to have someone who... The hotel concierge brings a phone to the beach. Dee Morey removes her sun hat and puts the phone to her ear. It's Dick.
Hello, love, he says. I trust you're as beautiful as ever.
The cop turned and handed her a card with his phone number on it. I understand this is a tough time, but in case you feel like going out sometime. She stared at the card. Dee Morey sighs. I saw The Exorcist, Dick.
Oh, Jesus, he says. That's shite. You know how to hurt a fellow.
No, she tells him gently. It's not exactly the bard. Dick laughs.
Listen, darling, I've got this play I thought we might do together.
The cop reached for the door. Deborah took a deep, ragged breath and followed him inside. Pat was sitting on a folding chair in an empty room, head in his hands, fingers lost in those currents of wavy brown hair. He pushed his hair aside and looked up at her. Those eyes. No one understood how much they were in this together, Pat and her. We're lost in this thing, Dee thought. There was a small abrasion on his forehead, almost like a carpet burn. Otherwise he looked fine. Irresistible. His father's son. He leaned back and crossed his arms. Hey, he said, mouth rising up in that sly, what are you doing here, smile. So how is your date? Chapter 14 The Witches of Porto Vergogna. April 1962. Porto Vergogna, Italy. Pasquale slept through the next morning. When he finally woke, the sun had already crested the cliffs behind the town. He climbed the stairs to the third floor in the dark room where Dee Morey had stayed. Had she really just been here? Had he really been in Rome just yesterday, driving with the maniac Richard Burton? It felt as if time had shifted, warped. He looked around the small stone-walled room. It was all hers now. Other guests would stay here, but this would always be Dee Morey's room. Pasquale threw open the shutters and light poured in. He took a deep breath, but smelled only sea air. Then he picked up Alvis Bender's unfinished book from the nightstand and thumbed through the pages. Any day now, Alvis would show up to resume writing in that room. But the room would never belong to him again. Pasquale returned to his room on the second floor and got dressed. On his desk he saw the photograph of Dee Morey and the other woman laughing. He picked it up. The photo didn't begin to capture Dee's sheer presence, not the way he remembered it. Her graceful height, and the long rise of her neck and deep pools of those eyes, and the quality of movement that seemed so different from other people, lithe and energetic, no wasted action. He held the photo close to his face. He liked the way Dee was laughing in the picture, her hand on the other woman's arm, both of them just beginning to double over. The photographer had caught them at a real moment, breaking up in laughter over something no one else would ever know. Pasquale carried the photo downstairs and slid it into the corner of a framed painting of olives in the tiny hallway between the hotel and the trattoria. He imagined showing his American guests the photo, and then feigning nonchalance. Sure, he would say. Film stars occasionally stayed at the Adequate View. They liked the quiet, and the cliff tennis. He stared into the photo and thought about Richard Burton again. The man had so many women. Was he even interested in Dee? He would take her to Switzerland for the abortion. And then what? He would never marry her. And suddenly, he had a vision of himself going to Porto Venere, knocking on her hotel room door. Dee, marry me. I will raise your child as my own. It was ridiculous, thinking that she would marry someone she'd just met, that she would ever marry him. And then he thought of Amedea, and was filled with shame. Who was he to think badly of Richard Burton? This is what happens when you live in dreams, he thought. You dream this, and you dream that, and you sleep right through your life. He needed coffee. Pasquale went into the small dining room, which was full of late morning light, the shutters thrown open. It was unusual for this time of day. His Aunt Valeria waited for the late afternoon to open the shutters. She was sitting at one of the tables, drinking a glass of wine. That was odd for 11 in the morning, too. She looked up. Her eyes were red. Pasquale, she said, her voice cracking. Last night, your mother. She looked at the floor. He rushed past her to the hall and pushed open Antonia's door. The shutters and windows were open in here, too, sea air and sunlight filling the room. She lay on her back, a bouquet of gray hair on the pillow behind her, mouth twisted slightly open, a bird's hooked beak. The pillows were fluffed behind her head, the blanket pulled neatly to her shoulders and folded once, as if already prepared for the funeral. Her skin was waxy, as if it had been scrubbed. The room smelled like soap. Valerio was standing behind him. Had she discovered her sister dead and then cleaned the room? It made no sense. Pasquale turned to his aunt. "Why didn't you tell me this last night when I got back?" "It was time, Pasquale," Valeria said. Tears slid through the scab lands of her old face. "Now you can go marry the American." Valeria's chin fell to her chest, like an exhausted courier who has delivered some vital message. "It was what she wanted," the old woman rasped. Pasquale looked at the pillows behind his mother and at the empty cup on her bedside table. "Oh, Zia," he said. "What have you done?" He lifted her chin, and in her eyes he could see the whole thing. The two women listening at the window while he talked to Di More, understanding none of it. His mother insisting, as she had for months, that it was her time to die, that Pasquale needed to leave Porto Vergogna to find a wife. His Aunt Valeria making one last desperate attempt when she tried to get the sick American woman to stay with her witch's story about how no one ever died young here. His mother asking Valeria over and over, "Help me, sister," begging her, hectoring. "No, you didn't." Before he could finish, Valeria slumped to the ground, and Pasquale turned with disbelief toward his dead mother. "Oh, mamma," Pasquale said simply. It was all so pointless, so ignorant. How could they misconstrue so completely what was happening around them? He turned to his sobbing aunt, reached down, and took her face between his hands. He could barely see her dark, wrinkled skin through the blur of his own tears. "What did you do?" Then Valeria told him everything. How Pasquale's mother had been asking for release ever since Carlo died, and had even tried to suffocate herself with a pillow. Valeria had talked her out of it, but Antonia persisted until Valeria promised her that, when her older sister could stand the pain no more, she would help. This week, she had called in this solemn promise. Again, Valeria said no, but Antonia said that she could never understand because she wasn't a mother. That she wanted to die rather than burden Pasquale anymore. That he would never leave Porto Vergogna so long as she was alive. So Valeria did as she'd asked, baked some lye into a loaf of bread. Then Antonia had Valeria leave the hotel for an hour, so that she would have no part in her sin. Valeria tried once more to talk her out of it, but Antonia said she was at peace, knowing that if she went now, Pasquale could go off with the beautiful American. "Listen to me," Pasquale said. "The American girl? She loves the other man who was here, the British actor. She doesn't care about me. This was for nothing." Valeria sobbed again and fell against his leg, and Pasquale stared down at her bucking, thrashing shoulders until pity overwhelmed him. Pity and love for his mother would have wanted him to do what he did next. He patted Valeria's wiry nest of hair and said, "I'm sorry, Zia." They looked back at his mother, lying against the fluffed pillows, as if in solemn approval. Valeria spent the day in her room weeping, while Pasquale sat on the patio smoking and drinking wine. At dusk he went with Valeria and wrapped his mother tight in a sheet and a blanket, Pasquale giving one last gentle kiss to her cold forehead before covering her face. What man ever really knows his mother? She'd had an entire life before him, including two other sons, the brothers he'd never known. She'd survived losing them in the war and losing her husband. Who was he to decide that she wasn't ready, that she should linger here a bit longer? She was done. Perhaps it was even good that his mother believed he would run off with some beautiful American when she was gone. The next morning, Tommaso the Communist helped Pasquale carry Antonia's body to his boat. Pasquale hadn't noticed how frail his mother had gotten until he had to carry her this way, his hands beneath her bony, bird-like shoulders. Valeria peeked out from her doorway and said a quiet goodbye to her sister. The other fishermen and their wives lined the piazza and gave Pasquale their condolences. "She's with Carlo now," and "Sweet Antonia," and "God rest." And Pasquale gave them a small nod from the boat as Tommaso once again pulled the boat motor to life and chugged them out of the cove.
"It was her time," Tommaso said as he steered through the dark water.
Pasquale faced forward to keep from having to talk anymore, from having to see his mother's shrouded body. He felt grateful at the way the salty chop stung his eyes. In La Spezia, Tommaso got a cart from the wharf watchman. He pushed Pasquale's mother's body through the street, like a sack of grain, Pasquale thought shamefully, until they finally arrived at the funeral home, and he made arrangements to have her buried next to his father as soon as a funeral mass could be arranged. Then he went to see the cross-eyed priest who had presided at his father's mass and burial. Already overwhelmed with confirmation season, the priest said he couldn't possibly say a requiem mass until Friday, 2 days from now. How many people did Pasquale expect at the service?
"Not many," he said.
The fishermen would come if he asked them. They would spit-flatten their thin hair, put on black coats, and stand with their serious wives while the priests intoned, "Antonia, requiem aeternam dona eis domine." And afterward, the serious wives would bring food to the hotel. But the whole thing seemed to Pasquale so predictable, so earthbound and pointless. Of course, it was exactly what she would have wanted, and so he made arrangements for the funeral mass, the priest making a notation on a ledger of some kind and looking up through his bifocals. And did Pasquale also want him to say Trigesimo, the mass 30 days after the death to give the departed a final nudge into heaven?
"Fine," Pasquale said.
"Eccellente," Father Francisco said, and held out his hand.
Pasquale took the hand to shake it, but the priest looked at him sternly, or at least one of his eyes did.
"Ah," Pasquale said, and he reached in his pocket and paid the man.
The money disappeared beneath his cassock, and the priest gave him a quick blessing. Pasquale was in a daze as he walked back to the pier where Tommaso's boat was moored. He climbed back in the grubby wooden shell. Pasquale felt terrible again that he had transported his mother this way. And then he recalled the strangest moment, almost at random. He was probably 7. He awoke from an afternoon nap, disoriented about the time, and came downstairs to find his mother crying and his father comforting her. He stood outside their bedroom door and watched this, and for the first time Pasquale understood his parents as beings apart from him, that they had existed before he'd been alive. That's when his father looked up and said,
"Your grandmother has died,"
and he assumed it was his mother's mother. Only later did he learn that it was his father's mother. And yet, he had been comforting her. And his mother looked up and said,
"She is the lucky one, Pasquale. She's with God now."
Something about the memory caused him to tear up, to think again about the unknowable nature of the people we love. He put his face in his hands, and Tommaso politely turned away as they motored away from La Spezia. Back at the adequate view, Valeria was nowhere to be found. Pasquale looked in her room, which was as cleaned and made up as his mother's had been, as if no one had ever been there. The fishermen hadn't taken her away. She must have hiked out on the steep trails behind the village. That night the hotel felt like a crypt to Pasquale. He grabbed a bottle of wine from his parents' cellar and sat in the empty trattoria. The fishermen all stayed away. Pasquale had always felt confined by his life, by his parents' fearful lifestyle, by the hotel adequate view, by Porto Vergogna, by these things that seemed to hold him in place.
Now he was chained only to the fact that he was completely alone. Pasquale finished the wine and got another bottle. He sat at his table in the trattoria, staring at the photo of Di More and the other woman as the night bled out and he became drunk and dizzy. And still his aunt didn't return. And at some point he must have fallen asleep, because he heard a boat, and then the voice of God bellowed through his hotel lobby.
"Buongiorno," God called. "Carlo? Antonia? Where are you?"
And Pasquale wanted to weep, because shouldn't they be with God, his parents? Why was he asking for them, and in English? But finally Pasquale realized he was asleep, and he lurched into consciousness just as God switched back to Italian.
"Cosa un ragazzo deve fare per ottenere una bevanda qui intorno?"
And Pasquale realized, of course, it wasn't God. Elvis Bender was in his hotel lobby first thing in the morning, here for his yearly writing vacation, and asking in his sketchy Italian,
"What's a fellow gotta do to get a drink around here?"
After the war, Elvis Bender had been lost. He returned to Madison to teach English at Edgewood, a little liberal arts college. But he was sullen and rootless, prone to weeks of drunken depression. He felt none of the passion he'd once had for teaching, for the world of books. The Franciscans who ran the college tired quickly of his heavy drinking, and Alvis went back to work for his father. By the early 50s, Bender Chevrolet was the biggest dealership in Wisconsin. Alvis's father had opened new showrooms in Green Bay and Oshkosh, and was about to open a Pontiac dealership in suburban Chicago. Alvis made the most of his family's prosperity, behaving in the auto business as he had at his little college, and earning the nickname All Night Bender among the dealership's secretaries and bookkeepers. The people around Alvis attributed his mood swings to what was euphemistically called battle fatigue. But when his father asked Alvis if he was shell-shocked, Alvis said,
"I get shelled every day at happy hour, Dad."
Alvis didn't think he had battle fatigue. He'd barely seen combat, so much as life fatigue. He supposed it could be some kind of post-war existential funk, but the thing eating him felt smaller than that. He just no longer saw the point of things. He especially couldn't see the angle in working hard or in doing the right thing. After all, look where that had got Richards. Meanwhile, he'd survived to come back to Wisconsin and what? Teach sentence diagramming to morons? Sell Bel Airs to dentists? On his better days, he imagined that he would channel this malaise into the book he was writing, except that he wasn't actually writing a book. Oh, he talked about the book he was writing, but the pages never came. And the more he talked about the book he wasn't writing, the harder it actually became to write. The first sentence bedeviled him. He had an idea that his war book would be an anti-war book, that he would focus on the drudgery of soldiering, and his book would feature only a single battle, the 9-second firefight in Streptoia in which his company had lost 2 men. That the entire thing would be about the boredom leading up to those 9 seconds. That in those 9 seconds, the protagonist would die. And then the book would go on anyway, with another, more minor character. This structure seemed to him to capture the randomness of what he'd experienced. All the World War II books and movies were so damned earnest and solemn. Audie Murphy stories of bravery. His own callow view, he felt, fit more with books about the First World War, Hemingway's stoic detachment, Dos Passos' ironic tragedies, Celine's absurd black-hearted satires. Then one day, as he was trying to coax a woman he'd just met into sleeping with him, he happened to mention that he was writing a book, and she became intrigued. "About what?" she asked.
"It's about the war," he answered.
"Korea?" she asked, innocently enough, and Alvis realized just how pathetic he'd become. His old friend Richards was right.
They'd gone ahead and started another war before Alvis had finished with the last one. And just thinking about his dead friend made Alvis properly ashamed of how he'd wasted the last 8 years. The next day, Alvis marched into the showroom and announced to his father that he needed some time off. He was returning to Italy. He was finally going to write his book about the war. His father wasn't happy, but he made Alvis a deal. They could take 3 months off, as long as he came back to run the new Pontiac dealership in Kenosha when he was through. Alvis quickly agreed. And so he went to Italy. From Venice to Florence, from Naples to Rome, he traveled, drank, smoked, and contemplated, and everywhere he went he packed his portable Royal without ever removing it from the case. Instead, he'd check into a hotel and go straight to the bar. Everywhere he went, people wanted to buy a returning GI a drink, and everywhere he went, Alvis wanted to accept. He told himself he was doing research, but except for an unproductive trip to Strathoia, the site of his tiny firefight, most of his research involved drinking and trying to seduce Italian girls. In Strathoia, he woke terribly hungover and went for a walk, looking for the clearing where his old unit had gotten into the firefight. There he came across a landscape painter doing a sketch of an old barn. But the young man was drawing the barn upside down. Alvis thought maybe there was something wrong with the man, some sort of brain damage. And yet there was a quality to his work that drew Alvis in, a disorientation that seemed familiar.
"The eye sees everything upside down," the artist explained. "And then the brain automatically reverses it. I'm just trying to put it back the way the mind sees it."
Alvis stared into the drawing for a long time. He even thought about buying it. But he realized that if he hung it this way, upside down, people would just turn it over. This, he decided, was also the problem with the book he hoped to write. He could never write a standard war book. What he had to say about the war could only be told upside down, and then people would probably just miss the point and try to turn it right side up again. That night in La Spezia, he bought a drink for an old partisan, a man with horrible burn scars on his face. The man kissed Alvis's cheeks and smacked his back and called him comrade and amico. He told Alvis the story of how he'd gotten those burns. His partisan unit had been sleeping in a haystack in the hills when, without warning, a German patrol used a flamethrower to rouse them. He was the only one to escape alive. Alvis was so moved by the man's story that he bought him several rounds of drinks, and they saluted each other and wept over friends they had lost. Finally, Alvis asked the man if he could use his story in the book he was writing. This caused the Italian to begin weeping. "It was all a lie," the Italian confessed. "There'd been no partisan unit, no flamethrower, no Germans." The man had been working on a car 2 years earlier when the engine had suddenly caught fire. Moved by the man's confession, Alvis Bender drunkenly forgave his new friend. After all, he was a fraud too. He'd talked about writing a book for 10 years and hadn't written a single word. The two drunken liars hugged and cried and stayed up all night confessing their weak hearts. In the morning, a dreadfully hungover Alvis Bender sat staring at the port of La Spezia. He only had 2 weeks left of the 3 months his father had given him to figure this shit out. He grabbed his suitcase and his portable typewriter, trudged down to the pier, and started negotiating a boat ride to Porto Venere. But the pilot misheard his slurred Italian. 2 hours later, the boat bumped into a rocky promontory in a closet-sized cove, where he laid eyes on a runt of a town, maybe a dozen houses in all, clinging to the rocky cliffs, surrounding a single sad business, a little pensione and trattoria, named, like everything on that coast, for St. Peter. There were a handful of fishermen tending nets in little skiffs, and the owner of the empty hotel sat on his patio reading a newspaper and smoking a pipe, while his handsome, azure-eyed son sat daydreaming on nearby rock. "What is this place?" Alvis Bender asked,
And the pilot said, "This is Porto Vergogna."
Port of shame.
Wasn't that where he wanted to go? And Alvis Bender could think of no better place for himself, and said, "Yes, of course." The proprietor of the hotel, Carlo Tursi, was a sweet, thoughtful man who had left Florence and moved to the tiny village after losing his two older sons in the war. He was honored to have an American writer stay in his pensione, and he promised that his son, Pasquale, would be quiet during the day so Alvis could work. And so it was that in the tiny top-floor room, with the gentle wash of waves on the rocks below, Alvis Bender finally unpacked his portable Royal. He put the typewriter on the nightstand beneath the shuttered window. He stared at it. He slipped a sheet of paper in, cranked it through. He put his hands on the keys. He rubbed their smooth, pebbled surfaces, the lightly raised letters. And an hour passed. He went downstairs for some wine and found Carlo sitting on the patio.
"How is the writing?"
Carlo asked solemnly.
"Actually, I'm having some trouble," Alvis admitted.
"With which part?"
Carlo asked.
"The beginning."
Carlo considered this.
"Perhaps you could write first the ending."
Alvis thought about the upside-down painting he'd seen near Strettoia.
"Yes, of course. The ending first."
He laughed. Thinking the American was laughing at his suggestion, Carlo apologized for being stupido.
"No, no," Alvis said. "It was a brilliant suggestion."
He'd been talking and thinking about this book for so long, it was as if it already existed. As if he'd already written it in some way. As if it was just out there in the air, and all he had to do was find a place to tap into the story, like a stream flowing by. Why not start at the end? He ran back upstairs and typed these words. "Then spring came, and with it the end of my war." Alvis stared at his one sentence. So odd and fragmented. So perfect. Then he wrote another sentence, and another. And soon he had a page, at which point he ran down the stairs and had a glass of wine with his muse, the serious, bespectacled Carlo Tursi. This would be his reward and his rhythm. Type a page, drink a glass of wine with Carlo. After 2 weeks of this, he had 12 pages. He was surprised to discover that he was telling the story of a girl he'd met near the end of the war, a girl who had given him a quick hand job. He hadn't planned to even include that story in his book, since it was apropos of nothing. But suddenly it seemed like the only story that mattered. On his last day in Porto Vergogna, Alvis packed up his few pages and his little Royal and said goodbye to the Tursi family, promising to return next year to work, to spend 2 weeks each year in the little village until his book was done, even if it took the rest of his life. Then he had one of the fishermen take him to La Spezia, where he caught a bus to Liciana, the girl's hometown. He watched out the window of the bus, looking for the place where he'd met her, for the barn and the stand of trees, but nothing looked the same, and he couldn't get his bearings. The village itself was twice as big as it had been during the war, the crumbly old rock buildings replaced by wood and stone structures. Alvis went to a trattoria and gave the proprietor Maria's last name. The man knew the family. He'd gone to school with Maria's brother, Marco, who had fought for the fascists and was tortured for his efforts. Hung by his feet in the town square and bled like a butchered cow. The man didn't know what had become of Maria, but her younger sister Nina had married a local boy and lived in the village still. Alvis got directions to Nina's home, a one-story stone house in a clearing below the old rock walls of the village, in a new neighborhood that was spreading down the hill. He knocked. The door opened a crack, and a black-haired woman stuck her face out the window next to the door and asked what he wanted. Alvis explained that he'd known her sister in the war.
"Anna?"
the girl asked.
"No, Maria," Alvis said.
"Oh,"
she said, somewhat darkly. After a moment, She invited him into the well-kept living room.
Maria is married to a doctor, living in Genoa.
Alvis asked if she might have an address for Maria.
Nina's face hardened. She doesn't need another old boyfriend from the war coming back. She's finally happy. Why do you want to make trouble?
Alvis insisted he didn't want to make any trouble.
Maria had a hard time in the war. Leave her be, please.
And then one of Nina's children called for her, and she went to the kitchen to check on him. There was a telephone in the living room, and like a lot of people who had only recently gotten a telephone, Maria's sister kept it in a prominent place, on a table covered with figures of saints. Beneath the phone was an address book. Alvis reached over, opened the book to the M section, and there it was. The name, Maria. No last name, no phone number, just a street number in Genoa. Alvis memorized the address and closed the book, thanked Nina for her time, and left. That afternoon, he took a train to Genoa. The address turned out to be near the harbor. Alvis worried that he'd gotten it wrong. This did not appear to be the neighborhood of a doctor and his wife. The buildings were brick and stone, built one on top of the other, their heights like a musical scale descending gradually to the harbor. The ground floors were filled with cheap cafes and taverns that catered to fishermen, while above were flop apartments and simple hotels. Maria's street number led to a tavern, a rotted wood rat hole of a place with warped tables and a ragged old rug. A rail-thin, smiling barman sat behind the counter, serving fishermen in droopy caps, bent over chipped glasses of amber. Alvis apologized, said he must have the wrong place.
"I'm looking for a woman," he began.
The skinny bartender didn't wait for a name. He just pointed to the stairs behind the bar and held out his hand.
"Ah."
Knowing exactly where he was now, Alvis paid the man. As he climbed the stairs, he prayed there was some mistake, that he wouldn't find her here. At the top was a hallway that opened into a foyer with a couch and two chairs. Sitting on the couch, talking in low voices, were three women in nightgowns. Two of the three were young. Girls, really, in short nighties, reading magazines. Neither of them looked familiar. In the other chair, a faded silk robe over her nightgown, smoking the last of a cigarette, sat Maria.
"Hello,"
Alvis said. Maria didn't even look up. One of the younger girls said in English,
"America, yes? You like me, America?"
Alvis ignored the younger girl.
"Maria,"
he said quietly. She didn't look up.
"Maria."
Finally, she glanced up. She seemed 20 years older, not 10. A thickening had occurred in her arms, and there were lines around her mouth and eyes.
"Who's Maria?"
she asked in English. One of the other girls laughed.
"Stop teasing him, or give him to me."
With no trace of recognition in her voice, Maria gave Alvis the prices in English for various amounts of time. Above her was an awful painting of an iris. Alvis fought the urge to turn it upside down. He bought a half hour. No stranger to this kind of place, he paid Maria half the agreed-upon price, which she folded and took downstairs to the man behind the bar. Then Alvis followed her down the hall to a small room. Inside there was nothing but a made bed, a nightstand, a coat rack, and a scratched foggy mirror. A window looked out on the harbor and the street below. She sat down on the bed, its springs creaking, and began to undress.
"You don't remember me?"
Alvis asked in Italian. She stopped undressing and sat on the bed, unmoved, no recognition in her eyes. Alvis began slowly telling her in Italian how he'd been stationed in Italy during the war, how he'd met her on a deserted road and walked her home one night, how on the day he met her he'd reached a point where he didn't care if he lived or died, but that after meeting her he had cared again. He said that she'd encouraged him to write a book after the war, to take it seriously, but that he'd gone home to America.
Ricorda? Wisconsin?
And drank away the last decade. His best friend, he said, had died in the war, leaving behind a wife and a son. Alvis had no one, and he'd come home and wasted all of those years. She listened patiently, and then asked if he wanted to have sex. He told her that he had gone to Lichiana to look for her, and he thought he saw something in her eyes when he said the name of the village. Shame, perhaps, because he had been so humbled by what she did for him that night. Not the part with her hand, but the way she'd comforted him afterward, held his crying face against her beautiful chest. That was, he said, the most humane thing anyone had ever done for him.
I'm so sorry, Alvis said, that you became this.
This? She startled Alvis by laughing. I've always been this. She waved at the room around her and said in a flat Italian, Friend, I don't know you, and I don't know this village you speak of. I've always lived in Genoa. I get boys like you sometimes. American boys were in the war and had their first sex with a girl who looked like me. It's fine. She looked patient, but not particularly interested in his story. But what were you going to do? Rescue this Maria? Take her back to America? Alvis could think of nothing to say. No, of course he wasn't going to take her back to America. So what was he going to do? Why was he here?
You made me happy, choosing me over the younger girls, the prostitute said, and she reached out for his belt. But please, stop calling me Maria.
As her hands expertly undid his belt, Alvis stared at the woman's face.
It had to be her, didn't it? And now, suddenly, he wasn't so sure. She did seem older than Maria should. And the thickening he'd attributed to age, could this actually be someone else? Was he confessing to some random whore? He watched her thick hands unbutton his pants. He felt paralyzed, but he managed to pull himself away. He buttoned his pants and cinched his belt again.
Would you rather have one of the other girls? The prostitute asked.
I'll go get her, but you still have to pay me.
Alvis took out his wallet, his hands shaking. He pulled out 50 times the price she'd quoted him. He placed the money on the bed, and then he spoke quietly.
I'm sorry I didn't just walk you home that night.
She just stared at the money. Then Alvis Bender walked out, feeling as if the last of his life had seeped out in that room. In the front room, the other whores were reading their magazines. They didn't even look up. Downstairs, he edged past the skinny, grinning bartender, and by the time he burst outside into the sun, Alvis felt crazy with thirst. He hurried across the street toward another bar, thinking, "These bars, thank God, they go on forever." It was a relief that he would never exhaust all the bars in the world. He could come to Italy once a year to work on this book, and even if it took him the rest of his life to finish it and drink himself to death, that was okay. He knew now what his book would be. An artifact, incomplete and misshapen, a shard of some larger meaning. And if his time with Maria was ultimately pointless, a random encounter, a fleeting moment, perhaps even the wrong whore. And so be it. In the street, a truck veered around him, and he was jolted out of his thoughts long enough to look back over his shoulder, up at the brothel he had just left. There, in the second-story window, stood Maria. At least, that's what he would tell himself, leaning against the glass, watching him, her robe open a little, her fingers stroking the place between her breasts where he had once pressed his face and sobbed. She stared at him a second longer, and then she backed away from the window and was gone. After that burst of prolific writing, Alvis Bender never made much more progress on his novel when he came to Italy. Instead, he'd cat around Rome or Milan or Venice for a week or two,
drinking and chasing women, then come and spend a few days in the quiet of Porto Vergogna. He'd rework that first chapter, rewrite it, reorder things, take a word or two out, put a new sentence in, but nothing came of his book. And yet it always restored him in some way, reading and gently reworking his one good chapter, and seeing his old friend Carlo Tursi, his wife Antonia, and their sea-eyed son Pasquale. But now, to find both Carlo and Antonia dead like this, to find Pasquale a full-grown man, Alvis wasn't sure what to think. He had heard of couples dying in short order like this, the grief just too much for the survivor to bear. But it was hard to get his mind around. A year earlier, Carlo and Antonia had both seemed healthy. And now they were gone?
When did this happen? He asked Pasquale.
My father died last spring. My mother 3 nights ago, Pasquale said. Her funeral mass is tomorrow.
Alvis kept searching Pasquale's face. He'd been away at school the last few springs when Alvis had come. He couldn't believe this was little Pasquale, grown into this man. Even in his grief, Pasquale had the same strange calm about him that he'd had as a boy, those blue eyes steady in their easy assessment of the world. They sat on the patio in the cool morning, Alvis Bender's portable typewriter and suitcase at his feet where Pasquale had once sat.
I'm so sorry, Pasquale, he said. I can go find a hotel up the coast if you want to be alone.
Pasquale looked up at him. Even though Alvis's Italian was usually pretty clear, the words were taking a moment to register for Pasquale, almost as if they had to be translated.
No, I would like you to stay.
He poured them each another glass of wine, and slid Alvis's glass to him.
Grazie, Alvis said.
They drank their glasses of wine quietly, Pasquale staring at the table.
It's fairly common couples passing one after the other that way, said Alvis,
whose knowledge sometimes seemed to Pasquale suspiciously broad.
To die of...
He tried to think of the Italian word for grief.
Dolore.
No.
Pasquale looked up slowly again.
My aunt killed her.
Alvis wasn't certain he'd heard right.
Your aunt?
Yes.
Why would she do that, Pasquale?
Alvis asked.
Pasquale rubbed his face. She wanted me to go marry the American actress.
Alvis thought Pasquale might be insane with grief.
What actress?
Pasquale sleepily handed over the photo of Dee Morey. Alvis took his reading glasses from his pocket, stared at the photo, then looked up. He said flatly,
Your mother wanted you to marry Elizabeth Taylor?
No, the other one,
Pasquale said, switching to English, as if such things could only be believed in that language.
She come to the hotel 3 days. She make a mistake to come here.
He shrugged. In the 8 years Alvis Bender had been coming to Porto Vergogna, he'd seen only 3 other guests at the hotel, certainly no Americans, and certainly no beautiful actresses, no friends of Elizabeth Taylor.
She's beautiful, Alvis said. Pasquale, where is your Aunt Valeria now?
I don't know. She ran into the hills.
Pasquale filled their wine glasses again. He looked up at his old family friend, at his sharp features and thin mustache, fanning himself with his fedora.
Alvis, Pasquale said, is it okay if we do not talk?
Of course, Pasquale, Alvis said.
They quietly drank their wine, and in the quiet, the waves lapped at the cliffs below, and a light, salty mist rose in the air as both men stared out at the sea.
She read your book,
Pasquale said after a while.
Alvis cocked his head, wondering if he'd heard right. What did you say?
The American.
He pointed to the blonde woman in the photo.
She read your book. She said it was sad, but also very good. She liked it very much.
Really?
Alvis asked in English. Then,
well, I'll be damned.
Again it was quiet, except for the sea on the rocks, like someone shuffling cards.
I don't suppose she said anything else,
Alvis Bender asked after a time, once again in Italian. Pasquale said he wasn't sure what Alvis meant.
"Concerning my chapter," he said. "Did the actress say anything else?"
Pasquale said he couldn't think of anything if she had. Alvis finished his wine and said he was going up to his room, Pasquale asking if Alvis wouldn't mind staying in a second-floor room. The actress had stayed on the third floor, he said, and he hadn't gotten around to cleaning it. Pasquale felt funny lying, but he simply wasn't ready for someone else in that room yet, even Alvis.
"Of course," Alvis said,
and he went upstairs to put his things in his room, still smiling at the thought of a beautiful woman reading his book. And so Pasquale was sitting at the table alone, when he heard the high rumble of a larger boat motor, and looked up just in time to see a speedboat he didn't recognize round the breakwater into Porto Vergogna's tiny cove. The pilot had come too quickly into the cove, and the boat rose indignantly and settled in the backsplash of its own chop. There were three men in the boat, and as the boat rumbled up to the pier, he could see them clearly. A man in a black cap piloting the boat, and behind him, sitting together in back, the snake Michael Dean and the drunk Richard Burton. Pasquale made no move to go down to the water. The black-capped pilot tied to the wooden bollard, and then Michael Dean and Richard Burton climbed out of the boat, stepped onto the pier, and began making their way up the narrow trail to the hotel. Richard Burton seemed to have sobered up, and was impeccably dressed in a wool suit coat, cuffs of his shirt sleeves peeking out, no tie.
"There's my old friend," Richard Burton called to Pasquale as he climbed toward the village. "I don't suppose Dee's returned here, sport?"
Michael Dean was a few steps behind Burton, taking measure of the place. Pasquale looked behind him, at the sad cluster of his father's village, trying to see it through the American's eyes. The small block and stucco houses must look as exhausted as he felt, as if, after 300 years, they might yet lose their grip on the cliffs and tumble into the sea.
"No," Pasquale said.
He remained seated, but as both men reached the patio, Pasquale glared up at Michael Dean, who took a half step back.
"So you haven't seen Dee?"
Michael Dean asked.
"No,"
Pasquale said again.
"See, I told you,"
Michael Dean said to Richard Burton.
"Now let's go to Rome. She'll turn up there. Or maybe she'll go on to Switzerland after all."
Richard Burton ran his hand through his hair, turned and pointed to the wine bottle on the patio table.
"Do you mind terribly, sport?"
Behind him, Michael Dean flinched. But Richard Burton grabbed the bottle, shook it, and showed Dean that it was empty.
"Outrageous fortune,"
he said, and rubbed his mouth as if he were dying of thirst.
"Inside is more wine," Pasquale said. "In the kitchen."
"Bloody decent of you, Pat,"
Richard Burton said, patting Pasquale on the shoulder and walking past him into the hotel. When he was gone, Michael Dean shuffled his feet and cleared his throat.
"Dick thought she might have come back here."
"You lose her?" Pasquale asked.
"I suppose that's one way to put it."
Michael Dean frowned, as if considering whether or not to say any more.
"She was supposed to go on to Switzerland, but it looks like she never got on the train."
Michael Dean rubbed his temple.
"If she does come back here, could you contact me?"
Pasquale said nothing.
"Look," Michael Dean said, "this is all very complicated. You only see this one girl, and I'll admit it's been rough business for her. But there are other people involved, other responsibilities and considerations, marriages, careers. It's not simple."
Pasquale flinched, recalling when he'd said the same thing to Dee More about his relationship with Amedea. "It's not simple." Michael Dean cleared his throat.
"I didn't come here to explain myself. I came here so you could pass on a message if you see her. Tell her I know she's angry, but I also know exactly what she wants. You tell her that. Michael Dean knows what you want, and I'm the man who can help her get it."
He reached into his jacket and produced another envelope, which he extended to Pasquale. There's an Italian phrase I've grown fond of in the last few weeks. Con molta discrezione. With much discretion. Pasquale waved the money off like it was a hornet. Michael Dean set the envelope on the table. Just tell her to contact me if she comes back here. Capisce? Richard Burton appeared in the doorway then.
Where'd you say that wine was, Captain?
Pasquale told him where to find the wine, and Richard Burton went back inside. Michael Dean smiled.
Sometimes the good ones are difficult.
And he is a good one? Pasquale asked, without looking up.
Best I've ever seen.
As if on cue, Richard Burton emerged with the unlabeled wine bottle.
Right then. Pay the man for the vino, Dino.
Michael Dean put more money on the table, twice the cost of the bottle. Drawn by the voices, Alvis Bender came out of the hotel, but stopped suddenly in the doorway, staring dumbfounded as Richard Burton toasted him with the dark wine bottle.
Chin chin, amico,
Richard Burton said, as if Alvis were another Italian. He took a long pull from the bottle and turned to Michael Dean again.
Well, Dina, I suppose we've worlds to conquer.
He bowed to Pasquale.
Conductor, you've a lovely orchestra here. Don't change a thing.
And with that, he began making his way back to the boat. Michael Dean reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a business card and a pen.
And this?
With some fanfare, he signed the back of the card and put it on the table in front of Pasquale, as if he were doing a magic trick.
Is for you, Mr. Torsi. Maybe someday I can do something for you, too. Con molta discrezione, he said again.
Then Michael Dean nodded solemnly and turned to follow Richard Burton down the stairs. Pasquale picked up the signed business card, flipped it over. It read, Michael Dean, Publicity, 20th Century Fox. In the doorway of the hotel, Alvis Bender stood stock still, staring open-mouthed as the men made their way down toward the shore.
Pasquale,
he said finally.
Was that Richard Burton?
Yes, Pasquale sighed. And that might have been the end of the whole episode with the American cinema people, had not Pasquale's Aunt Valeria chosen that very moment to reappear, staggering from behind the abandoned chapel like an apparition, mad with grief and guilt and a night spent outside, her eyes vacant, gray hair bursting from her head like blown wire, clothes dirty, her hunger-hollowed face streaked with muddy tears.
Diavolo!
She walked past the hotel, past Alvis Bender, past her nephew, down toward the two men retreating to the water. The feral cats scattered before her. Richard Burton was too far ahead, but she hobbled down the trail toward Michael Dean, yelling at him in Italian.
Devil, killer, assassin.
Omicida,
she hissed.
Assassino cruento.
Nearly to the boat with his bottle, Richard Burton turned back.
I told you to pay for the wine, Dean.
Michael Dean stopped and turned, put his hands up to pitch his usual charm, but the old witch kept coming. She raised a knobby finger, pointed it at him, and affixed him with an accusing lamentation, a horrible curse that echoed against the cliff walls.
Io ti maledico a morire lentamente, tormentato dalla tua anima miserabile.
I curse you to a slow death, tormented by your miserable soul.
God damn it, Dean,
yelled Richard Burton.
Would you get in the boat?
Chapter 15. The rejected first chapter of Michael Dean's memoir. 2006. Los Angeles, California. Action.
Now where to start?
Birth, the man says.
Fine. I was birthed fourth of six to the bride of a savvy lawyer in the City of Angels in the year 1939. But I was not truly born until the spring of 1962, when I discovered what I was meant to do. Before that, life was what it must be for regular people. Family dinners and swimming lessons, tennis,
summers with cousins in Florida, fumbles with easy girls behind the schoolhouse and movie theater. Was I the brightest? No. Best looking? Not that.